fix your bike, how to keep it tuned up so it's there for you when you need it. Or maybe you know already, but you just need to borrow a bike-specific tool that you don't have. Well, come to the Bike Lab.
Almost every Saturday since 2004, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., here in Northampton at 12 Northern Avenue.
Come with your bike or your questions.
And your willing attitude.
Spare parts scavenger hunt every weekend.
Venga para el Bike Lab de Northampton y se divertirá mucho, le enseñará muchas lecciones cómo arreglar bicicletas.
All repairs guaranteed to the end of the driveway.
Details are online at pedalpeople.coop. That's the Saturday Bike Lab at 12 Northern Avenue,
11 a.m. to 2 p.m.
They say freedom isn't free, but at the Bike Lab it is.
Ya súbase a la bici, compa. Trépese a la de montaña, la bici urbana, la bici cross. Lléguele a la bicicleta. Ya de menos a la eléctrica o a la estática, ya no hay tos. Llegaré pedaleando en el viaje de allá para acá.
You say I got to love my neighbor. Well, not really. Who would you say my neighbor is?
Who are my neighbors? Tune in to Out There to meet some of them. Out There airs every Wednesday from 4 to 5 in the afternoon with me, Ruthie Woodring. Come with me and my recorder to meet people and plants and think about ways we can share the world. That's Out There every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. here on Valley Free Radio. Get out if you can. But if you can't get out, tune in. That's today. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring, live in the studio. It's Wednesday, the day before the day we celebrate as Thanksgiving in the United States. And today's show, the biggest theme of today's show is about living space and living together. I have a bunch of little interviews or clips from Wayne Fiden and Carolyn Misch of the Planning Department in Northampton. Guests about living space. Who do I have? Marty talking about sharing space. A bunch of different little things. But the feature interview is with Rebecca and Paige, Rebecca Landis and Paige Bridgens, who are recent housemates. And I just interviewed them about what that's like to share that space. Also today, I have a little, I don't know, mix and match of other things. First, though, I just want to say that I'm really tired. I'm tired from hauling trash. And the most tiring thing that's been in the trash has been cat litter, used cat litter. Today, yesterday, the day before, just like cat litter. I mean, like this clay, it's like rocks. It's hauling around rocks. I just want to say, people, if you have cats and you use clay cat litter, please consider switching. You could switch to wheat-based or a newspaper-based or a pine pellet-based. There's probably others. A lot of cats have made the switch, and yours could be next. And if you have a testimonial about how your cat made the switch, feel free to call right now, 1-413-585-1033, and tell listeners how your cat switched to the healthy alternative, not clay. Thank you. Something else I want to say is many of you have heard of the attack Monday on Black Lives Matter activists by white supremacists in Minneapolis. The people who were attacked were near an encampment outside a Minneapolis police station demanding the release of video footage of an unarmed black man, Jamar Clark, who was shot and killed by police on November 15th, I believe. The five black men that were part of Black Lives Matter that were shot are surviving their wounds, and some of the people have been arrested. And when I think about terrorism and ways to fight it locally, when I think about strengthening communities and getting to know neighbors better and finding out what resources we have right around us and building trust and love, I have a couple of clips from people I talked to on the street this morning asking them some about those questions. But also I wanted to say that when I think about what can we do or what can I do, that's always the question. One small symbolic thing is to put a Black Lives Matter sign in your yard or apartment window. The local chapter of Black Lives Matter, BLM 413, has suggested to the mostly white anti-racist organization SURGE, which stands for Showing Up for Racial Justice, that this feels like an important thing to do. And an equally important part of putting up the signs is the conversations with neighbors that lead to the signs being put up. Let's see. Yeah, so the Yard Signs campaign is largely about these conversations with neighbors about racism, so people like myself who struggle with oblivion learn to see it, start paying attention to ways our society is constructed that make lighter-skinned people seem like the standard and normal, and those expected to be in positions of power and authority, and those expected to be the rule rather than the exceptions. Yeah, Northampton has plenty of its own problems. I've seen racist graffiti around town, and there's lots of stories of racist things that happen here. And I've talked with some, I consider them white supremacists. So a yard sign might seem inconsequential. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe it is. But combined with talking and writing and raising awareness about racism in our community and organizing to change the policies and structures that continue white supremacy, well, it's a start. And if you want a yard sign but are anti-trash, like me, we have some 100% reused yard signs. And if yard signs aren't appropriate for your living situation, we have small poster-sized signs that you can put inside your window. You can call me at the station. You can go to the SURGE website. I think it's SURGE is a national group, so... there's a Facebook page. The Western Mass SURGE is a Facebook page. And lots of good information about different working groups involved in SURGE and what they're doing and ways that you can plug into one of the working groups. I missed the meeting on Monday, so I don't know exactly all the stuff that's going on right now this week, but there's lots of stuff. So I'm going to cut to a couple of clips of people that I talked to this morning about their reactions to the shootings in Minneapolis and terrorism-related stuff. This is Kat.
What do you think about terrorism? Like, is white supremacy terrorism? What is terrorism? Is there any meaning to calling that terrorism?
I think terrorism, by definition, is, like, using terror as a way to control people. I mean, by that definition, it's what people do to each other constantly, all the time. If you live in an abusive household or under any form of government, we are living in terrorism. I feel like the politicians are using these acts of violence almost as a form of terrorism to, like, benefit themselves and get them elected in, because they're sort of fear-mongering and getting everyone to be terrified that it's going to happen again, and it's going to happen over and over again, and with the Syrian refugees, and then they can sort of put themselves in a position to say, I can stop that, and then they get more support. And it's really frustrating.
Any thoughts on what you and I can do?
I don't know. Just try and not act terrified of everyone. Talk to people.
Yeah.
It seemed like more reminiscent of civil rights era violence than what we've been seeing with Black Lives Matter so far. I mean, in terms of perhaps like police violence against protesters and it being so geared towards protests on police violence, that's somewhat similar to civil rights era. But to have protesters actually gunned down in public was pretty surprising to me this day and age.
Any thoughts on terrorism, and are these white supremacist shootings, is that terrorism, or is there a point to trying to classify it as terrorism? What's the difference between terrorism and hate crimes? I don't even know. Any thoughts on that?
I would call it terrorism. I mean, I think the intent is to scare people from protesting against, you know, racism. So the intent is to incite terror in order to get people to stop doing something. And in terms of the difference between hate crimes and terrorism, I feel like a hate crime would be like if they shot a black man because they hate all black people or something like that. But to shoot at protesters, I mean, I guess it's like you hate all, maybe you hate all protesters, but it seems like they're like a white supremacist group is against people of color. So if they're killing people of color who aren't protesting, that seems like a hate crime. But if they're killing protesters who are trying to do something about white supremacy, then that seems like terrorism to me.
And that was Barry Thebos. The next thing is I asked Barry a little bit about Thanksgiving.
So tomorrow is Thanksgiving, and there's different ways of celebrating. Barry, can you tell us about the day of mourning?
Sure. Every Thanksgiving, or every day that Thanksgiving is celebrated since, I believe, sometime in the mid or early 70s, Native American folks have been organizing in Plymouth, Massachusetts, to basically bear witness to the true history of Thanksgiving, which was not a celebratory event between Native Americans and pilgrims, but actually the true history is more of a massacre of the Pequot Indians. And I can't reference all the exact statistics, but I believe it was hundreds of Pequots were killed. And the actual Thanksgiving was pilgrims or colonialists coming back to celebrate their victory of massacring Pequots. But the Day of Mourning has kind of more broad implications than that, and it's a lot about where things stand today for Native peoples and just trying to bring awareness to that and bear witness to that. And they've made a lot of good things happen. So, yeah, but every Thanksgiving in Plymouth, I would encourage anyone that has the ability to go, because it's a very inspiring event. They often have really inspiring speakers, and there's a march through Plymouth, and they got the municipality of Plymouth to install a statue of, they had a more kind of offensive historical statue that was giving sort of the myth of Thanksgiving, but now they have, I think, a statue of Massasoit. Anyway, they've gotten a lot of things to change on a symbolic level, and they've gotten a lot of people organized that are doing great work all the time. So I think it's a great event. And Leonard Peltier often has written like a letter to folks who meet there, and there's a lot of support for releasing him from prison. He's been in prison for decades and decades. So I think it's a really important event for all Americans to be aware of, and a really important history.
Did you go last year?
I did go last year.
Are you going tomorrow? Do you know anyone who's going tomorrow from Western Massachusetts?
I am not going tomorrow. No, there are so a few folks going from this area, and carpooling is encouraged.
Well, listeners can contact me, and I'll contact you and see what the possibilities are if you want to go.
Okay.
Thanks, Barry.
Sure. I just also wanted to say that giving thanks is a very important tradition for everyone, and also in particular, I think, for Native peoples, and that the Day of Mourning is not in any way against giving thanks. It's just to recognize the true history of what happened on the day that we often call Thanksgiving.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP, Northampton. This is Out There. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. That was just a little interview with Barry Thebos. And for the next part of the show, I'm going to talk about living space and how we can share it.
They're building a new house on Blackberry Lane, right next to the rail trail. I see it when I ride by. I've been noticing it for the last few months, being under construction. And I think about infill being an important part of keeping cities and towns dense to reduce environmental impact of transportation and infrastructure costs.
While I'm supportive of infill, I think that filling in is even more important. And by filling in, what I mean is consider the houses that are already built. How many people are living in them? Could people live in those houses and keep the green space too? How much could we increase the density in the city of Northampton and still keep the green spaces that we have?
So I looked online for some statistics because I know that the square footage of living space per person has really increased a lot. And what I found online, it says that in the late 1800s, up until I think around the 1940s, 1950s, the average square footage of living space per person was about 150 to 200 square feet nationally in the United States. And today, 850 square feet per person. So it's like quadrupled. So I went by City Hall this morning to the planning department and talked with Carolyn Misch and Wayne Fiden a little bit about infill and development and their thoughts on that.
City of Northampton encourages infill in places where we have existing services, water, sewer, schools, and access to those services, so along the bike paths and pedestrian ways. We promote infill for the purposes of having a more sustainable community so that people aren't forced to use their cars to go to meet all their needs on a daily basis.
Do you have any thoughts about trying to for people to live more densely in buildings that already exist? Or do you know if there's how much extra space, or I would call extra space, there is in current buildings, excluding that 12,000 square foot house?
Well, it's tough to know how much extra space there is within the existing buildings. However, one of the reasons that we recently modified the zoning was to allow flexibility for people who feel like they are in homes that are too big to either maintain or too costly to maintain, and this allows them the flexibility to add units to better utilize that space and to also offset costs that homeowners might have to bear by themselves otherwise. We don't have any policies necessarily in place that encourage shared living arrangements, but we've always, for many, many years, have had definitions in the zoning that allow up to four unrelated people to share and occupy one unit, and we still count it as one unit. We don't subdivide, we don't make a distinction between those. So in that sense, you could create a living situation where you've got more than one or multiple family structures living and occupying the same space.
Well, it's interesting because infill's become a bad word in some circles. Uh-huh. And one of the things we stress is because the fewer number of people per house unit, if you look at the data for the last 40 years, the number of people who live in walking distance of downtown keeps dropping because we're getting some new housing units, but the number of people per unit drops so fast. Mm-hmm. So one of our arguments is, at best, all we're doing is keeping the population the same it is, or maybe the same it was 20 years ago. It's not like it's really going to grow dramatically. It just might stop the shrinkage from doing this. So we have, I think, about 60% of our population lives in a mile of downtown. Mm-hmm. But that number's been declining as fewer people live in per unit.
But the overall population of Northampton, the square, whatever, Northampton is similar, you're saying?
Has declined very, very slightly. So we were stable for about 40 years. Uh-huh. About 20 years ago, we started, or 15 years ago, we started declining. Uh-huh.
So all these new places are being built, but the population hasn't increased.
Right. And some of that, of course, is obviously the fewer people per dwelling unit.
Yeah.
But some, remember, if you go back 30 years, we had a state hospital with a lot of people living, and we had a lot more people at the VA hospital. So the group quarters has dropped dramatically. So that's thrown us off a little bit.
We weren't encouraging development out in the outlying areas.
Yes.
So one way to discourage it would be to require more land area.
Uh-huh. Yeah. The infrastructure costs in terms of like electricity, sewage, plowing, streets maintenance, all that.
Right.
School buses.
Yeah.
So this is Valley Free Radio, WXOJ, you're listening to Out There. That was just an interview with Carolyn Misch and Wayne Fiden in the planning department. It's in the city for the city of Northampton. I'm going to play a little song, and then after that is the interview with Rebecca and Paige, the feature interview of two people who decided to share their living space. This is Malvina Reynolds.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university, where they were put in boxes, and they came out all the same. And there's doctors and lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And they all play on the golf course and drink their martinis dry, and they all have pretty children, and the children go to school, and the children go to summer camp, and then to the university, where they are put in boxes, and they come out all the same. And the boys go into business and marry and raise a family in boxes made of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
Wow, that was a pretty cynical song. Just because you heard it on Out There doesn't mean I agree with everything that's said. I guess that song should be about big boxes these days. Carolyn had referenced, or I had referenced, the 12,000 square foot house in the interview with Carolyn Misch. That's because she told me that, yes, there is a 12,000 square foot house in Northampton. So this next piece is an interview with Paige Bridgens and Rebecca Landis, who recently moved in together, and I'll just let them tell their story.
So, talking with Paige and Rebecca. So, Paige, you've lived by yourself for many years. How long have you been living alone?
Well, it's been about 15 years, though for about 5 years I was out in Williamsburg living with my mom, caring for her as she was dying. But now I'm back and have been living alone here for the past year.
Mm-hmm. And just this fall, you invited another housemate to live with you. And having known you for many years, I know you've talked about this in the past and talked about wanting to share resources and share the house that you live in. And it happened.
It did happen. And I'm really glad it did. And part of what made it happen was that this particular person met a lot of my criteria for a housemate. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, maybe we give it a try.
So, Rebecca, you went from living with a bunch of people to just living with a woman in her own house who'd had her own space for a long time. How has it been for you?
You know, I feel like I need to be honest and say it's been challenging. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, there's a certain amount of privacy that you have when you live with a lot of people, mm-hmm. that when you're living with just one other person, you don't have. And I'm the kind of person that needs a lot of privacy and time alone. And I'm still kind of navigating how much of that I need in my life and what is healthy and what is like running away or isolating myself, and what is like, no, I actually need some time alone. But I am so grateful for this opportunity because it's been a really good way for me to practice one, figuring out what my needs and wishes are in a living situation, and two, communicating them. And I don't think that's something I've ever done in a living situation before. So I'm really grateful for this opportunity, and I'm really grateful that it has been challenging. And I don't think that, I think that it's just living in a small place with one other person that is what's made it challenging for me and my personality.
Mm-hmm. How did you both decide that the likelihood of it being a good match was worth the risk? Because you didn't really, I mean, it's not like you weren't like longtime friends or you didn't really know each other that well or anything, right? So what was that process like?
I think for me, it was just an intuitive feeling that I had that maybe I don't think I knew really. Obviously, I didn't know what it was going to be like. I didn't know all the risks, but I just felt like this was the right thing or this was meant to be for some reason for me. And, I still feel that way. I still feel like this has been where I'm supposed to be. So I would say, yeah, it was just more of an intuitive feeling than anything else.
How about you, Paige?
I had met Rebecca through an interview she had on Out There about a walk that she took. This was an extended walk. And I just came away from listening to that episode of Out There feeling like this, I like this person. I would like to get to know this person. And yet I never did anything about it. I did run into her at where she was living before and got the chance to kind of see her again and kind of got to remember this was the person who went on that extended walk, very far walk. And so then when I heard that she was looking for a place to live, I took a few minutes to kind of think, am I ready? And I thought, you know, I'm ready to at least talk about it. And so we talked, and there were some things that made it possible to even consider. One being that Rebecca is car free. I have only one car space, and actually at this point in my life, I have a car. And it would have been really challenging to figure out another parking space and how to manage that. Another thing was that I knew that Rebecca didn't have a lot of stuff. And her relationship with things is not something that she takes for granted at all. That was going to be really important to me, especially at this time in my life when I have a lot of stuff. You know, I've had an accumulation of 62 years worth of things, plus my mother died, and I'm going through things. I didn't want to have a housemate who was going to be burdening this space with yet more stuff. And plus, I wanted that influence of someone who lives really spare when it comes to material possessions. I wanted that influence.
And I think we had like, we had to make a week to get ready for me to come too. I think that should also be noted. Like, we had the conversation about the possibility of me living here, and then a week later, literally a week later, I moved in.
Because you had to leave the place you were before.
Yeah. So.
Yes. Yes, that was a challenge. And I spent that week hustling. And, you know, some of that hustling was stuff that needed to be done anyway. Me going through my stuff and clearing out a bedroom and making it clean. And some of it was the psychological preparation of like, oh, my God, how do we share a 6-cubic-foot refrigerator? It's been challenging enough for me with my own food. And you know, so I thought, these are things that we can deal with.
So in terms of some of the challenges, like privacy and noise and communicating about those things, that can be really hard sometimes. How do you deal with these conflicts?
Well, I think I've always been afraid of communicating because I thought communication meant a conflict or it meant some kind of confrontation. And so what I've found really helpful is to first take some time to think about how I can get really clear about what I want to communicate, and then realize that, and once I take that time and get really clear, I see that, no, this isn't a conflict. This is just sharing something that I would like to do and then checking in with the other person to see how they feel about it and then going from there. And that doesn't always mean that I don't want to say I get what I want, because that's not even what it's about for me. But I've also found that sometimes what I need is just to express that I have a need. And sometimes just saying it out loud is really helpful. So, yeah, I think it's been, like I said, I'm so grateful for this opportunity because I've never, like, practiced communicating in this way before. And it's such an exciting discovery that it doesn't have to be a conflict, actually.
I'm surprised to hear that you have not communicated like this before. You're very skilled at this communication, and it doesn't feel like a burden or a big conflict when you do address the issues that come up for you. And it's been really welcoming to hear, because sometimes it answers little questions that lurk in my mind and that I haven't bothered to inquire about. And so the communication has been, I've really welcomed your telling me what works, what doesn't, what you need for your space, and what you need for your literal space and your sound space and, you know, food needs and all the different things.
Rebecca, unless there's anything else you want to add, I might just continue the interview with Paige since it's time for you to go on a walk.
Okay.
Thanks, Ruth.
Thanks, Ruthie.
Bye, Rebecca.
Bye. So, Paige, like we said before, you'd live by yourself for a while. What were some of the challenges or, like, the fears? What were your concerns? Some things that, reasons why you didn't have a housemate before?
One challenge was the smallness of the space. This is a really small house by a lot of North American standards, by Northampton standards. And I had lived in group settings before where the bedrooms were, you know, a world unto themselves. And you could go off to your room and have your privacy. You could come to the common space and have share, you know, the common life. And this feels so different because it is a small space. By the standards of the rest of the world, this is an enormous space. And I felt this clawing need to share this space, even though I felt that, you know, by most people's standards, this might be difficult. And indeed, with Rebecca, you know, she has expressed, you know, sound concerns. And, you know, it's difficult to make a phone conversation without being heard. So we've decided to get yesterday she suggested the idea that we get a white noise machine. And I've always been, well, I have not liked those machines at all.
Using up electricity just to make noise?
Yeah, exactly. Noise? I mean, don't we have enough noise? Don't we have enough noise? And I would never imagine that I would agree to bringing one of those in here. And yet, it feels like a small measure that will make the space needs easier and maybe even possible. Mm-hmm. It, you know, and this is part of like having her move in is I get to see parts of me open up that I might have really been closed to before, to try to not get lodged in the rigid stance I've had on, say, those machines.
Uh-huh. I mean, because... so I think my observations and judgments are that the reason that you have things the way you have them, the way you like them in your house, in many instances, has to do with conservation and environmental awareness and trying to reduce resources. But just the fact of sharing your house with another human being, like, just cuts in half so many things. And it's huge.
Right. Right. And another example of using more energy now than before is that Rebecca felt the need for more lighting in the kitchen. And me, I use a couple of night lights to illuminate the kitchen. You know, I just don't need a whole lot of lighting. So, again, this was a chance for me to say, let's weigh this here. Could I live with more lighting, knowing that it means another person can be living here? So I got a pretty nice LED bulb, and we now have more lighting in the kitchen, and it doesn't have to be on all the time. And when it is, it's fine. So I think, as you said, just the mere fact of having this 900 square feet shared is markedly different from having a person living here alone.
You know, I should probably mention that you also share your house with the bike lab. Had a whole lot of bicycles and bike parts.
That's true. And that's been now 12 or 13 years, something like that.
Let's see.
And that, too, was full of some surprises and, you know, a chance to open my mind. It's different from sharing a living space.
In terms of, like, concerns that you had going into it or ways that it's changed your life?
So one of the concerns I had when I considered Rebecca moving in was, what do I do on those nights when I don't sleep? Mm-hmm. And I need to get up and ramble around and maybe take a bath. And then I thought, you know what? Let's get over the insomnia. Mm-hmm. Let's cut back the morning coffee. Mm-hmm. And this is something that needed to happen anyway, independent of her moving in here. And but she was the goad, mm-hmm, for making that happen. And it's been great. I've been sleeping really, really well. Mm-hmm. I do get concerned when I get up in the night. Do I take my leg brace off? You know, the sound of Velcro waking her up, or do I leave my leg brace on, you know, which makes a little noise when I walk on it. So, but anyway, we've worked through things like that, and she says she doesn't hear it. You know, another concern was just the exposure, you know, just having someone in an hourly way present to how I live my life and how I don't live my life and, you know, what the accumulation of my life so far has yielded. Mm-hmm. And sometimes these are things that might be a little uncomfortable for me to see. And so to have somebody there who sees them and I see these things through their eyes, mm-hmm, you know, might be difficult. And then I thought, you know what? It's okay. It's okay. She can see just who I am, and that's going to be all right. She can see that every evening I make dinner, and I sit down and watch Democracy Now, and I do my exercises, and I go to bed. It's a pretty simple life, mm-hmm, and she's not witnessing my having mastered musical instruments, or, you know, that I'm spending my evening, you know, on Tuesdays I play in a band, or, you know, no. I have a really, really simple life. And it is okay for her to see that. Mm-hmm. And so I've kind of decided what I can let go of in terms of concerns, and to morph other concerns into taking action. The refrigerator was a concern. So I have this counter height refrigerator. This is a 6 cubic foot refrigerator. And before Rebecca moved in, I didn't have space. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a challenge to mm-hmm. find the space to put all my food in there. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how am I going to share this? And so I went through the damn thing and I pulled out a lot of crap. Mm-hmm. And thought, don't I do this pretty often? You know, that there's a lot of waste happening here. And I know that I'm fully capable of being more on top of it, you know, of cleaning it out more often. So now I am going through the refrigerator more often. And I made a little refrigerator out on the side porch that's a crock. And that's where I keep my big bulky greens. Mm-hmm. And it's so much a non-problem. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like she has helped me move through some stagnation mm-hmm. by moving in here and by my choosing to make space here for more than just myself. And, you know, another thing has been nice is, so I've got all this stuff, and she came with like a tiny box of possessions. So it was great to just have some of this stuff that was my mom's, and, you know, some of it in a trunk and not in use. Some of it wasn't in use for 30 years. You know, we got out these blankets and, you know, the things that she needed for, you know, making a nice bedroom. So again, just bringing things out of stagnation and bringing them, you know, some vitality to the house through eliminating that stagnation.
So that was an interview with Paige Bridges and Rebecca Landis talking about moving in together. The show, a lot of it has been about living space. I mentioned earlier in the show that the square footage of living space per person in this country has quadrupled since like the mid-1900s. And so I just wanted to talk about, have guests talk about ways to share that and reduce that, and what some of the joys and challenges are of living together. The next clips, you're listening to Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 FM, Northampton. The next set of clips are from a guy that shares space outside and some of the challenges of that.
She was like, that's all I do, share space. I feel like if I didn't share space, I'd probably have everything I ever wanted.
if you didn't share space.
Yeah, I didn't have to share space. Just like the material things that I want and emotional wise. But like last night, or in nights before, I share really close quarters with like four other people. So we're all camping together, and we're all like lying right next to each other. And so last night I was just sleeping with one other person because the other three were somewhere else. And he took off his shoes and his feet really stunk. I was just like, dude, put your shoes like over there. get inside your sleeping bag. Oh my god. Maybe now I know how it feels like when other people smell my feet. I don't know, maybe. I think my feet, I don't mind the smell of my feet, but I could understand why other people don't.
Yeah. So what ended up happening last night?
No, he just didn't move his shoes really so much far. I guess he put them in a good spot. I was downwind, so like it was just all blowing in my face. But he got in his sleeping bag, and then I could smell it less. And then he put his boots not exactly where I thought he was going to put them, but still I think he put it in like a spot. Like just like a little pocket where the wind wasn't catching anything,
mm-hmm.
which is good. Yeah.
So, how did you come to be living with the people you're living with right now?
I just met him on the street, and we just had a lot of fun together, and then they were going to bed, and they were like, they invited me to come with them. Mm-hmm. And so I just went to where they were camping, which was under the bridge, and we hung out and went to sleep and woke up next day and went on with our day, mm-hmm. hanging out and doing what we do.
And it's worked out all right so far?
It's been a little rough, actually. I've had to witness the couple fighting, which isn't fun.
Yeah.
One's a paranoid schizophrenic or whatever, so she had a little freak out, and her boyfriend got a pretty good beating. Mm-hmm. And so that wasn't fun to watch and actually have to be a part of, because we had to hold her down, and he wanted to call the ambulance, and I didn't want any part of that because I've had my experience with ambulances and police and stuff like that, and I just didn't want to do that to her, and mm-hmm. I didn't like it myself, so it's not something I want to put somebody else through.
Mm-hmm. Was he okay?
He's all right. Mm-hmm. He's okay. He's got scratches and mm-hmm. a whole bunch of scratches all over his face, black eyes. And
what about her? Did she, like...
He didn't calm do anything to her. She finally calmed down, yeah. And he checked her into the hospital yesterday, and then she stayed there for a little bit. And they probably gave her some medication, and then she came back. So that's a little rough.
Yeah.
Not something you really want to be a part of, but there's no avoiding it when you're in that kind of situation.
Yeah. The next little clip is from Gus. And so, Gus, what's been your experience on how much living space a family might need?
Depends on the family. I think three of us lived really well in 500 square feet. When it became four of us, and when the babies started to become mobile, 500 square feet wasn't enough for all of us to have our personal space, especially with someone in the house who had no respect for personal space. So what's that? Three people in 500 square feet is, maybe you round it up, 200 square feet per person, mm-hmm. I think is entirely livable. Mm-hmm. I've lived in group housing where the common space was tiny, but we all had our private space,
yeah.
And that worked really well.
How long were you and your family in this 500 square feet space?
We're there for about 4 years and then built a much larger addition because we had lived in such a small space for so long.
So the same day that I was doing these interviews, I also ran into a friend, Rod Snelling, on the rail trail. And this is what he shared.
I was pleased to be able to present what's called an elevator pitch for an enterprise over at Smith College recently. The 90-second pitch, usually it's to address folks who are potential investors and that sort of thing. My pitch was improvised, but it was for a Christian worker cooperative that would build what's called tiny houses. That is, structures typically about 7 by 11 feet in area. And the tiny houses are usually transportable. And the idea here would be that they could be brought to just about any campus for any church around, Springfield that was up for joining in. And they would be able to form a community and offer affordable housing to old recent college grads who are sometimes neck deep in debt, looking for something affordable, or just about anyone else who was looking for something affordable. And if they moved on to other houses later on, well, they still have a good tiny house that they can make available to others. Also, the idea of a Christian worker cooperative helps in that there's a mutual teaching aspect to it, where folks learn how to build such houses, skills that they can, again, apply wherever they like.
I'm curious about the Christian connection and the Springfield connection. You said, is the Christian connection just for that, like, network of support and learning and teaching, or could it be any religion or social organization?
Partly the idea that one has to start somewhere, and I think churches tend to be up for the idea. It does dovetail with a lot of the Christian tradition. going even back to the first century.
In terms of the community?
Also, there's been around Springfield an interest in bringing in a greater variety of folks of different backgrounds and so on. And this sort of thing just might help toward that.
Mm-hmm. You mean like bringing in people from north of the Tofu Curtain to south of the Tofu Curtain? Or what kind of variety are you referring to?
Well, one does think of recent college grads from maybe the Five College area. But again, it's I think, potentially a good offer that could be made to a wide range of people.
This is one of the joys of living in community or living with other people in my house. Sometimes people like to sing music. Thanks to my housemates for making music, because that's not really my skill. You've been listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 FM in Northampton. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Thanks for tuning in today. Democracy Now! Is going to be up at 5 o'clock. I have one more little thing I think I'm going to play. First, actually, I want to say, though, that you can listen to archived editions of Out There online at weatherbeard.com/out there, weatherbeard.com/out there. It's now a podcast, thanks to Alex Jarrett, my friend and housemate. And you can subscribe, too, if you want. There's about 50 past editions that are becoming available since I started doing this show a year ago. And, okay, so the next little thing I'm going to play, someone asked me recently about when I was in school, the school had a towel in the bathrooms. The school had, like, a towel thing that came out of a, I don't know what you call it. Anyway, I'll let Bill Arnold talk about it.
Yeah. Okay, this is Bill Arnold. I have a building in Florence at 30 North Maple, and we have two of these hand towel dryer things, and there's a long roll of toweling, maybe 200 feet, and it's the old-fashioned type. You pull on it with your hand, you know, pull on it both sides, and then you get a fresh section of toweling. Then you dry your hands, and it clicks, and that's for the next person comes along, then they pull it down. It lasts, you know, in my building, it lasts about a week. And then we have to wash them and dry them and roll them and, you know, put them back in. And so you just keep using it, the same hand toweling. It's like the towels you use in your house. You don't throw them away. You wash them, and then you dry them, and then you put them back in the bathroom or the kitchen, whatever, and you use them again. It's the same thing. So we use them over and over and over again, and it doesn't fill up the landfill, and it doesn't fill up the trash. Makes a lot of sense. People were a little hesitant in the beginning because it was an old, forgotten technology. Some of us still remember how you just, when we were in school, that you just pulled on the thing and then the fresh towel came down. But for some people, it was completely new and maybe seemingly a little complicated. And there was always the thought of, well, how does it get clean? Does it get clean inside the machine? Well, it doesn't get clean. It's a giant roll, that's all. And just keeps coming around until you run out. Then you put a new roll in.
Thanks. And these machines, are they old, like antique machines, or are they currently manufactured? Do you know?
They're currently manufactured, and I do believe it's in Utica, New York. I talked to the woman up there who runs it, and I think it's a family business, been going on for a long time, and they're very helpful. Gave me extra stuff and told me all about it, and then they delivered them, and it was fine, and it's relatively simple, although it's an old technology.
Do you have any idea of cost comparison? Of course, environmental comparison.
Much cheaper than paying for the rolls of expendable toweling. I noticed that it was costing a great deal of money. Now, I don't remember exactly how much, but it's certainly over $100 each month in order to buy dispensable hand toweling, you know, that rough kind of toweling. So that's why I decided to invest in this. It costs a little bit more for the startup, but then it doesn't cost anything except for the, what does it cost to wash them? It doesn't cost very much to wash them, and then they dry them, and then they roll them back up in a roll, and then put them back in the machine.
Cool. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was Bill Arnold talking about the cloth towels at his building at 30 North Maple Street in Florence. Yeah, I ran into Bill when I was doing linen deliveries for Simple Diaper and Linen in Florence a couple of days ago, which reminds me, if you know someone who wants to join a workers' cooperative delivering diapers and linens and helping out in the laundry room, Simple Diaper and Linen is looking for a co-owner, co-worker. You can find them online at simple.coop. It's Bob. I believe it's part-time. And I think that's about it for today's show. Thanks for listening. Democracy Now! Is going to be up in just a couple minutes. Here's some other nice shows on Valley Free Radio.
A Baha'i Perspective, hosted by Warren Odess Gillette, is a weekly radio broadcast of biographical interviews of people who have either chosen the Baha'i faith as a way of life or who have a relationship with the Baha'i faith. You can listen to the broadcast on Saturdays at 10 a.m. on WXOJLP 103.3 FM. That's Valley Free Radio.
STDs often have no symptoms, but if left untreated, they can lead to serious health problems, especially for young women. Every year in the U.S., about 24,000 women become infertile from untreated STDs, which means they may never be able to have kids. It's important to get tested regularly. All STDs are treatable. Many are curable. GYT, get yourself tested. Go to gytnow.org to find a testing center near you. A message from CDC.
Hi, this is Virginia, Ukrainian singer and songwriter. When I'm in Northampton or even online, I listen to Rick Haggerty kicking it for peace, culture and education right here on 103.3 FM Northampton or online at valleyfreeradio.org. Sunday mornings from 8 to 10 a.m. And let each day be perfect. Yours, Virginia.
Make your morning commute 50 times more exciting with Girl Riot. Tune in to get your share of female musicians and vocalists, interviews with local bands, and girl gossip. Catch us on Wednesday mornings from 7 to 9 a.m. on the air at 103.3 FM or online at valleyfreeradio.org.
Every day in the electronic media, people talk, or more likely yell, about politics.
We do things differently.
Our job is to talk about the things that we hope will be of interest to you without all the shouting and anger.
We hope to provide facts and have reasonable discussions about the issues of the day.
That is to disagree without being disagreeable.
Join us every Friday at 7 p.m. for Civil Politics here on WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton or anytime online at civilpoliticsradio.wordpress.com.